mind changes anymore these days. So what years were you associated with Coolis?
From 67 through 89.
Okay. And did you, when in 67, is that what you said, 67?
Yes, that's our come for April 67.
Okay. And what rank did you start at when you
Captain.
Got here? Okay. And then at retiring, it was General?
Brigadier General.
Brigadier General. Wow. And what do you think the most memorable event was while you were here?
Oh, there's a lot of them. The year I got here, they had that big Fairbanks flood.
Okay.
And during that a 9-day period, I made 19 flights into Fairbanks.
Wow.
And one of the most memorable things about that flood was there's a group of high school teenagers that they wore yellow jackets.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were called the Yellow Jackets. And we were hauling supplies up to Fairbanks, food and medical supplies, and bringing people back because, you know, they had to have a place to live, and there was no place to live up there.
Right.
And we all take a load of stuff up and bring a load of people back.
Right.
And the Yellow Jackets would meet each individual or family,
uh-huh.
and then find places for them in Anchorage.
Wow.
And it was, but the only problem with that was about halfway through, we were running out of evacuees. And those kids would show up at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning,
wow.
waiting for airplanes to come back because we were sort of flying around the clock.
No kidding.
And I don't know how many people I hauled on the 19 flights, but we had just about all our airplanes flying.
Right.
In that period of time.
And how many airplanes did you have at
Eight.
That time? Eight.
Okay. Yeah, there was a C-123s.
Right. And during the Fairbanks flood, was Coolis a sort of a staging point for a lot of materials and goods that
yes.
went out there?
Yes.
And you guys were probably the main relief force to get up there, I would imagine.
Well, Wien Airlines at that time had passenger service.
Mm-hmm.
They were flying their airplanes and at no cost.
Wow.
You know, so they'd haul them people.
Yeah.
And Merrill Wien was one of our pilots,
mm-hmm.
but he's also a pilot for Wien Airlines. And he also had a helicopter.
Oh.
And he was hauling stuff in his helicopter out to various people.
Wow.
So, and once in a while, he'd hop on a 123 and relieve one of our pilots.
Wow.
And their airport was undamaged? You guys were landing at the airport in Fairbanks?
About 1,500 feet of each end of the runway up at Fairbanks was underwater.
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot of room for 123. It had
yeah.
all that space. In there.
Right.
Well, even the Wien airplanes and Alaska Airlines
mm-hmm.
could get in and out. It's just that the town was pretty much underwater.
Right, right. So how many people do you think that you were evacuated
oh,
from Fairbanks?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
That was a few years ago, and I told you about my good short memory.
So what were some of the other events that you remember while you were here?
When I first got up here, we did a lot of flying for the state. And in the springtime, we hauled the fish and game and federal fish and wildlife personnel and boats out to the various village areas.
Oh, okay.
And about every 2 years, they'd replace the state troopers' vehicles at the villages.
Oh.
And we'd do that.
Okay.
And it was in the early 70s that they started an FBI and OSI investigation of the Guard for hauling other than DOD cargo, violating regulations. And that investigation went on a long time, and we made got a lot of press on that.
Yeah.
And it was not good.
Right.
And the FBI they eventually turned files back over to us to do what we want with us. That big stack of it,
right.
They just took it out and burn it.
Huh.
But the when it came to the final, they get all the information that they wanted to, for taking the court or whatever they wanted to do with it. You know, and they had it all compiled.
Yeah.
They went in and they determined that most of that was not really covered in the regulation. And we was doing it, you know, it was all, mostly for, there was some few personal items that were hauled that that sort of cost people their job.
Right.
But that was very minor. And the final determination was they shouldn't do anything to punish the guard, but they should give them credit for what they've done.
You know,
be complimented, because all this is good stuff.
Yeah.
So they just said, King's X. Let's forget the whole thing. Let's just call it even and start over again.
Yeah, right.
And that lasted quite a while, and it all came out good in the end. And
right.
So during that investigation, did you guys stop doing transports for the state at that point, or did you still do it later when you were in command?
Well, there are some things for the state that we could do, you know, because. We're a state organization in peacetime.
Right. Yeah.
But we really had pretty much gotten out of that business anyway. You know, and then shortly after we got the C-130s. There's a DOD regulation, 4515-13R. of all the things I don't remember, I don't know I remember that one, because that says proper use of military aircraft, airlift aircraft.
Right.
And it's the Navy wanted us to do some particular thing. I can't remember what it was. A USO troop or something up the Nome, and it was. It wasn't quite. We've hauled USO troops before, you know, for the Air Force, but this was something for. It was a little bit different, and it wasn't covered. It wasn't legal according to that 4515-13R.
Right.
15R. And so I called back to Chief Master Sergeant back in the Pentagon, that worked in DOD to cover the reg, you know, to see if I'd get some more copies, because the Navy didn't have a copy of it. And so he looked it up, and the entire Navy only had 3 copies of it. Every guard unit in Alaska had a copy.
Right. Not very well prepared, were they?
But then we converted to the C-130s, and that was a big effort.
Yeah.
And we got the airplanes were pretty when we got them. You know, nice and clean and shiny.
Right.
But they were rotten on the inside.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was wing cracks and gear track cracks. And
so you inherited older ones? Used ones?
The E model was the model of the time. They were, but they had been in Vietnam.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
But the ones we got were from base down in Texas.
Okay.
And they put more effort into cleaning them up on the outside and not on the inside. And it took us a long time. We had several wing cracks and gearbox and tracks. And in one of the bays, we were finding tools that had been painted over. They were laying there, you know, and they put that zinc chromate paint, I think, on the inside of the box for corrosion.
Right.
And there'd be a tool covered with that paint. It's just laying there and you paint it over the top of it.
Some thorough work they did down there.
Then
attention to detail.
Then the next conversion we had was a little bit better, and I went back and we got them fresh off the factory floor.
Oh, good!
Brand new airplanes, the C-130Hs.
The H model.
Yeah, and that's the ones we have now. And I went back and picked up the first one.
Wow. So, in those conversions, did that change the type of missions that you were able to do? Because I know that the 123s had a much shorter, they could land and a lot dicier.
130 carry twice as much, twice as high, twice as fast.
That was a good.
And there's a big difference between the reciprocating engines had in the 123 and the turbo prop engines on the 130.
Right.
because right. the reciprocating engine's good for about 2,000 hours till it needs an overhaul, but the turboprop go 5-10 times longer than wow. that. It's a lot less moving parts for one thing.
Right.
They're not, and the parts aren't slamming back and forth.
Right.
You know, piston going down.
Right.
They're just going around in circles.
Yeah. Yeah. So what? With the mission changes, were there a lot of? Did that take a lot of personnel time to get everyone trained up to?
Well, you know, to convert from the 123 to the 130 was a big conversion program.
Yeah.
We had sent several people back to Little Rock to the C-130 training school, and the initial cadre, which I was the last one to go back, so I hung on to the C-123 string.
Yeah.
And the maintenance people, of course, are a different kind of airplanes, but it went fairly smooth. Then the conversion from the E model to the H model was just a model upgrade change. You know, that went really smooth. That was no major problem at all.
Yeah. And how did the conversion affect the buildings and what was happening on base? Did you get to have a lot of new maintenance buildings or anything that had to be changed with from the 123 to the 130?
I got lost. I couldn't find this place. I had to go ask the security police, you know, where the engineering building was. When I got here, we had 17 pilots and 2 navigators as far as air crews. Then we had the flight mechanics and that. And I think the total unit was about 250 or so, and there was about 130 or 140 full-time technicians. Mm-hmm. And it's a big change from that.
Yeah.
But the Alaska Air National Guard was called a Y-out program. They were going to, I forget how long it was. I think he had 3 years from the time I get up here, and then they were going to disband it.
Oh, wow.
But it was called the Wild. So no construction went on during that period.
Oh, no kidding.
And we had...
And what years was that?
67.
Okay.
When I got here in 67, okay. 68. And I think in 69, they dropped the Wild program. I think that was it. It was in that time frame.
Uh-huh.
And we started getting construction. But we had very few buildings. We had one hangar.
Right.
And an old James Way hut for the maintenance, the flight maintenance people.
Right.
And the,
right.
And we've been getting buildings ever since. You know, mm-hmm. Now they're going to lose it all. You know, it's a shame. You know,
yeah.
It took a long time to finally get the programs going.
Right. Got it just where you want it, and now it's going away. Huh? And were there any particular times that construction was more apparent than other times, or were there building programs or program changes
once it started rolling, it seemed that another building was coming online. You know,
right.
Since finished one, well, another one would come on.
Yeah. So was there a big change in attitude once the Cold War sort of wound down? I know that, you know, during the 60s and 70s, that was sort of high time for a lot of the Cold War tensions. And then by 89, when you left, that was...
Well, during the late 60s and early 70s, it was sort of the free spirit time, you know, and getting people to come. People didn't like the military. It's hard to get people to come in, and
right.
and hard to and getting people to get a haircut. You know, and the 3510 it covers the grooming standards, uniform grooming standards of the Air Force. And the Adjutant General at that time, General McCrassen, as soon as we got the 130s, we got them and started getting them in mid 1976, and I took over as commander about November of 1976.
Okay.
And my instructions on the grooming standards was people have to go by 3510, but don't make a big deal of it.
Gotcha.
Tell them to get their haircuts, but don't make a big deal of it.
Yeah.
Well, that didn't bode well for the Adjutant General, because he got called back. Because that it sort of tied my hands.
Right.
And it eventually come around that I sort of run in the middle. They every once in a while the recruiters would do a survey, and Colonel Bellier is too strict on 35-10 on half the people. Colonel Bellier is not strict enough on 35-10 on the other half.
Well, that means you're
okay.
Yeah, that's where you want to be.
It means you're doing your job.
And another one was when I took over as commander, I forgot the people said, well, you forgot where he came from. He's ignoring ops. And the other half is, all he does is pay attention to operations. He don't care about the rest of them. That's why it's, you know, but it's a, it was good. It was a, I made a rank of general because of the NCOs. And General McCrassen was a big supporter of the NCO force when he was on active duty in the Air Force. And people have jobs, and the NCO is a major, top, most important supervisor
right.
in the position. Let them do their job and stay out of their way. You know, and keep the monkeys off their back.
Right.
So I approach it that I worked for all the NCOs.
Yeah.
And, that, and then they had people working for them. And it worked. It worked good.
Yeah.
And morale, I think, was generally pretty high.
Mm-hmm. Were there any events that sort of upsetting events or any bad things that happened that you can remember that people still talk about?
Oh, I don't know. I'm trying to remember bad things sort of brings up bad things.
Yeah.
You know, and always try to look at the positive side.
Yeah.
You know,
it's well, were there? I know that there were a few crashes out here that people had to respond to that weren't necessarily they weren't Air Guard planes that crashed.
No, it was. I can't remember the date, but there was that one DC-10, I think it was, crashed. And several people were killed, and that.
Yeah.
And we got. I just lived about a mile from here,
mm-hmm.
And I heard the airplane crash.
Oh wow!
And the security guard called and said there's been an airplane crash. So I went out there, so I started calling people, and they started calling people. We initiated one of our recall programs.
Yeah.
And. One that I remember most was one of our nurses, her husband Bob Paulson, and his wife was a nurse out here, so I called him to come out, and when they had, I can't remember who answered the phone, but he said, "Oh, the colonel's having an exercise and they're calling everybody out." You know, a simulated crash exercise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then they come out and they saw all the traffic backed up.
Yeah.
And they found out, oh, gee, that really was real.
Yeah.
So they got a policeman, got a police escort to come in, Margie
right.
Paulson,
okay.
And she retires a full colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And this place was absolutely packed with good people.
Yeah.
And I couldn't have done anything without them, and I didn't have to do anything with them. That's what I enjoyed as far as the bad things. You know, that crash was bad. It was unfortunate that the airport, when they were building the new terminal,
mm-hmm.
had spent too much of their money on the upper one, on the terminal, and not on the fire. They only had three fire people. And you know, not enough to even run their equipment, and
right.
and they used most of our equipment, you know, and our fire people got involved in it.
Wow!
But Margie Paulson had some of her medical staff in, and they were there because our other people were there
right.
and wading around through that JP-4
right.
leaking fuel
yep.
and stuff.
Yep.
So we had to repair some of our people who were doing the work on the crash.
Wow!
Yeah.
Wow!
Was there an agreement with the airport that you guys would help out with fire?
Oh yes, oh yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That when Senator Stevens' airplane crashed out there,
yeah.
that it was the Air Guard that got the people out of the airplane.
Wow.
Oh wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was a pretty significant event.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, his wife was killed and the pilot was killed. And fortunately, he survived because he's done a lot for Alaska.
Yeah.
And he got us the C-130s.
Right.
And the upgrade. That, you know, other than bad things, you know, if there was really bad things other than that investigation we had, which turned out good.
Yeah.
And Fairbanks flood, you know, we were the good guys on that.
Yeah. Well, and the earthquake, I mean, lots
of... Oh, yeah, and that was just before I got here. And that,
yeah.
Can I take something off for a minute?
Oh.
Sure. Were there any issues with you guys being so isolated? I mean, Alaska in general being, you know, particularly isolated from the rest of the lower 48. Were there any issues that you ever ran into with having to deal with funny stuff because of that?
We were sort of a flying club. And that's every year on the 4th of July, that time period, 4th of July, the red salmon are running down in Bristol Bay, and we had a runway down there at Iggy Avi, and there'd be two dozen or so people from the Guard Bureau and the Air Force, you know, that had the... with Premier of Canada or whatever, he's been there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, haul them out to Iggy Agui.
Yeah.
Yeah, for 2 weeks, you know, and they'd catch, take back thousands of pounds of reds.
Wow.
And one year, it's called a Ship Creek Fly. It's a big treble hook with a weight welded onto it.
Yeah.
And that's what they're using. They're just snagging the reds out.
Yeah.
Well, one year, Fish and Game was waiting for them.
Oh, no.
And there was thousands of dollars of fines that they pay. They nailed a whole bunch of people.
Wow.
And they had the Catholic chaplain from the Pentagon was there fishing, and the guy's writing them up, and the chaplain says you wouldn't believe this, but I'm the chaplain of the Air Force. And he says, you won't believe this, but I'm a warden from the governor's office.
And he kept writing this.
But it started tapering off after that. And when we got to 130s, it's not a usable strip for the C-130.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It was only about 4,000 feet long and soft gravel.
Oh, right.
But these are all the head people from the Air National Guard, so they took care of their resort up here,
right?
You know, and that's it was hard to get over that image.
Yeah.
And one thing that helped, one thing that changed it, is instead of being under the Alaska Air Command, we came under TAC.
Okay.
Tactical Air Command. Yeah. Well, following all the tax rules, mm-hmm. in Alaska, and then that's when we had to start airdrop training and assault landing, training that. Before then, it was mostly just the cargo hauling, trash hauling.
Right.
And I said, we only had 17 pilots at that time.
Mm-hmm. And did you go through command changes, I mean, in terms of your major commands, so TAC and MAC and MATS? Were you ever part of MATS, or was that?
MAC was the last. Before they had the consolidation, and the MAC no longer existed, so now the unit's under PACAF.
Right. Okay.
And PACAF does the inspections. When I was here, it was MAC, and we had all the MAC inspections. And and we'd have two or three major inspections every year when I was commander out here. They may have didn't trust me. but MAC had a lot of money to send their people out.
Yeah.
About half that time, when we had a major MAC inspection, they have what the Air Force calls an over-the-shoulder. The Air Force sends their inspectors to inspect the MAC inspectors, inspecting us.
Right. Right.
So you get sort of touchy, you know, who's who.
Had a lot of brass out here looking over everyone's shoulder.
And one time, I'll mention the name. You can do whatever you want with it. It was Colonel Sutton was the commander of the MAC inspection team. Mm-hmm. And there was an over-the-shoulder inspection. Well, we got satisfactory on the inspection, which is really a bummer because we usually do better than that.
Yeah.
But the MAC inspection team failed the inspection.
Oh, wow.
They had us doing things that were unsafe, you know, and that right. they're going to bust us if we didn't do it, you know, and that
right.
and that that left a they when they were getting ready to leave, we had an airplane going, and so they were going to take them down to Scott because they had the MAC inspection team was going to do inspection down at Scott Air. I'm sorry, at McDonald. McCord.
Okay.
I know I get
yeah. Certain
McCord,
yeah.
These synapses, you know.
Yeah.
And so we had the out briefing, and then they were getting ready to go get on our airplane. And when I had to give a going away, you know, thing, I wasn't too happy with them.
Yeah.
And I said that and we'll be dropping you off at McCord on the way to where we're going. And said, I don't know if we're going to land or not. they really ticked a lot of people off.
Wow. And did those inspections, were there more or less under any particular, like with TAC versus MAC, were there?
I wasn't, it became PAC.
Okay.
After
PACAF.
And the PACAF. The thing, most of it was the minor things that there weren't that much difference. And we were under AEC for a time, and they would do the inspections. And we have a pilot gets two major tests a year: flying ability and instrument training. And the instructor. The examiner has to fill out a form, you know, how he does this. And then they want a word picture, you know, what the flight was all about.
Right.
Well, some of them were, it was a good flight, they weren't making much of a word picture. So we started doing that. Mm-hmm. Then the next time they come over, they said, well, they're making the word pictures now, but the previous flights, they didn't make the word picture, you know. Well, they're almost writing us up for the same thing
right.
that we had corrected it. Because
right.
you can't go back and
right.
change
right.
the inspections.
Yeah.
Then MAC took over, and then they didn't like the word picture. There's enough information on the sheet. You know,
right.
you do this, these good, bad, ugly, indifferent. You know,
So
they didn't want the word pictures.
Yeah.
But they're just trying to keep up. They wrote us up for an unsafe firing range.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it didn't have proper backing. We don't have a firing range. That's the airport. So
yeah.
Yeah. But it's one thing I noticed that it could consider my personal opinion, but a lot of people noticed when Mac took over. They didn't like the Air Guard procedures, maintenance procedures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, and eventually, the MAC or the Air Guard was doing the procedures according to how MAC wanted them done.
Right.
The Guard didn't change. MAC did.
Oh.
We had airplanes land from Elmendorf. We'd have a 130 land over here. Because of weather or something, mm-hmm. they couldn't get into Elmendorf. And they call up and said, could you pre-flight the airplane for us? That's when maintenance goes out and they make sure everything.
Right.
And they come in and they say, Colonel Bollier says, we're going to put that airplane in a red X. Because there's things wrong with the airplane that they're not supposed to fly with them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So they'd send over their own mechanics, you know, and then sign off on it.
Right.
So they They didn't call us to pre-flight the airplanes anymore.
Right.
And this is the nature of the beast. We had one, Colonel Nelson was the commander of 616th. And when he came over to get a tour of the guard, mm-hmm. and then when he got done, he's we'll fly the same kind of airplanes. And he said, one thing, he says, you have crew chiefs out there with 10, 15, 20, 21 years experience of maintenance. He said, that's how old my mechanics are. 18, 19, 21.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So it makes a big difference, you know. When people that it hadn't come natural, they just had tons more experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know what's going to happen now. The unit's going to move over to Elmendorf.
Yeah.
And I believe it's a sort of a co-op sort of thing that.
Yeah.
Going to be. Air Force and Air Guard flying the same airplanes.
Oh, really? So they're going to...
I think it's cross-fly agreement.
Wow.
And
did you guys always get along with Elmendorf?
That was my best farm club. my whole staff that I had for supply, maintenance, I'm missing something. Anyway, safety.
Mm-hmm.
All my staff members had come over from Elmendorf.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Lead navigator from Elmendorf. At one time, the adjutant general, Major General Krasin, he was the AAC commander. For a long time, several years ago.
Wow.
But I get along good with them. But first question. They come over and said, "Would you be interested in joining the guard?" Says my tour is up, and they said, "Well, does your wife like Alaska?" She says, "She's not going to leave. That's why I'm getting out."
Yeah, there seems to be a lot more longevity in a lot of the National Guard units than you ever see in the regular Air Force, because people
they're in their hometown on that. They grew up and their kids joined. My son-in-law, my first son-in-law, joined the Guard. My son's in the Guard.
Yeah. But did that ever make for any interesting times with having you and your son both on base at the same time?
No, not really. you met my son, Scott.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was on the biathlon team, National Guard biathlon team,
right,
for a long time.
Yeah.
And I'd go someplace, and I met General Edwards from Maine, and said, "Oh, you're Scott's dad."
So Scott made his own way through all of that. Huh?
He was at a meet over in Norway, and they had a reception line that they went through, and the Air Force advisor or Air Force liaison with the King of Norway was in the reception room. And went through the line and said, "I'm Scott." He says, "Oh, yes." Says, "We know when a general's son's here."
So there were little benefits. What do you think the biggest changes that you've seen in terms of the base or the Air Guard in general?
From the time I got here,
the
mission.
Yeah, the mission or the base itself.
The base, number one.
Yeah,
it is from what we had from a half a dozen little buildings, in one small hangar at the. It's amazing, and it's a shame to lose it. You know, one of the buildings there, from what I understand, one of the buildings they were trying to get the guard over at Elmendorf was a condemned building. But they've been tearing down old World War II buildings over there for years. And they're building hangars for the C-17, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
These are new hangars, and apparently they're not geared for the snow load for Alaska. I don't know how that's ever turned out. You know, just because of my son, I hear some of these things that But the base and the quality of the base and the people are always good, but now they're getting something that they deserve to have to work with, like this building here.
It's a beautiful building.
Yeah, and that used to be just a old tin building over there.
So, why do you think that they are bracking this particular base? I mean, it seems like they're just getting all this new stuff, and now...
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's trying to co-locate guard units on active duty bases, and I've been to several bases that have had a guard unit co-located for a long time.
Right.
And it doesn't work. Something's lost somewhere. You know, you're always the sort of the bastard child,
right?
And that's not right.
Yeah,
it's not right.
Yeah. Yeah, I was talking with someone else who had worked with at Fairchild or in Fairfield at Travis Air Force Base. They had a National Guard unit co-located there, and. And he said, you know, some things worked, but a lot of things didn't, and that people weren't as happy being co-located on active bases as they were just being on their own in the Air Guard bases.
Yeah, I went to train at Little Rock. They had a guard unit there, and they're sort of hid off in the corner someplace. Maybe that's good. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I was in the DC Guard for a year. Back in Washington, D.C., flying F-100s. Uh-huh. And there's a guard is located across the field, but still on an active duty base.
Right. And did you fly all the airplanes that, or all the aircraft that were out here?
I flew the C-130 and the uh-huh. C-123.
Okay. And before that, you did the F-100s?
Yeah, and the F-86 and the F-89 and the F-102.
Wow, cool.
F-84s.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I came up strictly as a fighter pilot when I came here. Then I started flying 123.
Okay. Was that a hard transition from being a fighter pilot to cargo pilot?
Not really hard. Yeah, as far as learning to fly, that's a... But it's a different mission. Now, flying fighters, you go out and you get in your airplane and you take off and you go do something and you come back and you land and you get out of the airplane, right, same spot you took off from.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, here you take off and the next thing you know, you're up in some Eskimo village someplace
and
planning on rivers and then on lakes.
Right.
And you don't do that in the fighter.
Right.
The mission is very interesting.
Yeah.
And that's an airplane is an airplane.
Yeah.
And then you get it, you fly in an airplane and you get up, you know, about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, you come out and you get your flight planning and you're going out and it's just starting to get daylight. You crank up the engine, you go out and then you line up on the runway. Freedom!
No, that's you're happy no matter what, you're flying.
It's, no matter what kind of airplane it is.
Yeah. So during Vietnam, was this a much more active base during some of those active conflicts?
Here, you mean?
Yeah.
No, it was pretty much a state support unit, because it takes a long time flying at 150 knots to get someplace. And, although we did go outside, I was gone for 2 weeks one time flying all over the country. Elmendorf at that time is busy. There was 141s landing there about every 15 minutes, hauling wounded back. That's the sad part. We'd have four days a week, we'd have an AAC mission. We'd go over, get up and be over at Elmendorf at 5:30 in the morning and pick up a load of cargo to take to one of the radar sites. That's what the AAC missions were. And those are some of those pretty long. Flap a barrel takes quite a while.
Yeah.
Most of them were fairly closer to Sperivan and Dutch Harbor and Dillingham. But the one at Dillingham, it's a 4,000-foot runway with one end's 800 feet higher than the other end.
Whoa.
So you landed uphill and took off downhill.
Wow.
And when you take off, you take off.
Yeah.
When you go, you got to go.
Yeah.
Once you start, you're committed.
And how long were the missions flown to all the Dew Line stations? Was that was that still happening while you were
Oh yes,
here?
Yeah. Even when we got the 130s, we'd fly 130s into the same places.
Right. Did any of those airstrips have to be modified for the 130s?
No.
Or they were all?
No, they're all long enough for the 130.
Yeah. Or
they used to fly 124s in there, if you're familiar with the C-124.
Right.
And they had 124s landing out at Dillingham. And he's coming in, and there was a guy, one of the airmen, he was anxious because his tour was up. He's going to go home. And he's standing in the runway, he's taking a picture of the 124, and the 124 caught a wing and
hit
the cartwheel. But as soon as that wing went down, all he got was pictures of gravel. He put the camera down and kept it running.
Oh, no.
He had some... nobody was killed. We were fortunate.
Wow,
you know, very fortunate.
Lucky.
But it totally demolished the airplane.
Yeah. And was that... other than the Dewline mission, what were some of the other major missions that
The Dewline is up on the coast, and then the other radar ACS sites are inland, you know, the Sparavon and the Otto McGrath, the Kootenai is that one, and Fort Yukon, you know, and a lot of missions to Galena and King Salmon.
Right.
So That's pretty much what a job was. And then any Eskimo village that had more than 2,500 feet of runway, we could haul supplies in there. That's where a lot of the fish and game stuff was getting set up.
So was wintertime more busy than, say, the summertime if you were having to transport things to, like, stranded Eskimo villages?
No, it's
pretty
steady. They're they're all air supported anyway.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so year round. So I don't know if there's any difference in the flying that we did, the amount of flying we did in summer or winter because of where it's needed, not what the weather is or what the season is.
Right. Right. And I guess Operation Santa Claus was probably going already while you were here, so that kept on as usual.
Before it was just to St. Mary's, you know, and that they'd collect toys, and that's where you go up and land on the river, on the Andrusky River.
Okay.
And then we got the 130s, and we started going. Operation Santa Claus goes to a lot of different places now because you do that. But we had one winter we had an exercise, went to a lake out of Kiana, which is the closest village.
Mm-hmm.
But we went up to that lake. It's a round lake, and set up a major operation with airplanes coming from California, Georgia, and Mississippi.
Wow.
On C-130s.
Wow.
Go up there and land on that lake and then go do airdrops from there.
Okay.
And we'd have as many as 10 C-130s on that lake.
Wow.
Well, on the first one, I went on the lead airplane because we had one of our airplanes went up to check it out, make sure we land on it.
Right.
And we picked up some of the people for the mission, picked them up at Fort Wainwright.
Mm-hmm.
And all the crews were in there. We had six airplanes, six C-130s, and we go on that particular mission. And they said, well, how thick is the ice? And they said, well, some places it's less than a foot thick. Some places even less than that.
Wow.
And how do you know? And so, well, don't matter. You know, the lake's only 4 feet deep, and it's froze solid, you know, and you got about a mile and a half, you know, it's a round lake, you know, it's just solid ice, you know? No big deal, but I thought I'd get him with that 6 inches of ice.
Yeah. He flinched, at that.
But another interesting mission we had was in 123s. We took, I can't remember the SEAL team, but we took a SEAL team up to St. Lawrence Island.
Wow.
They're going up there, and they're going to, we used to be the 38 Special Forces, the Army Guard with 38 Special Forces. And they're going to go up there and train them, you know, on the weapons training. And we dropped the SEAL team off, and then we went back to Nome to overnight. Mm-hmm. And then we had something else to do, because they were out there day in the second, the third day we went back to pick them up.
Right.
And then we was going to bring them back to Nome, and they're going to do some, well, they're going to do airdrops out of San Francisco, but they couldn't do the airdrops because the weather was too bad. You know, we could land, but we couldn't get up for them to airdrop. So we took them back to Nome, and we made arrangements with the airport and FAA up there to set up a drop zone. We had the combat control team from the Air Force.
Oh, okay.
So we set up, and we airdropped them there at the airport in Nome.
Oh,
they really thought that was great. And have you ever been to Nome?
I haven't.
You have?
No.
There's a Board of Trade. Is a hotel and a bar. That's the main bar.
Okay.
And we were in there after the drops and SEAL teams. And the sand says, you know, we get out there and those Eskimo, they can't hit a target to save their soul. They set up the Ryan. It's just, you know, they're all over the target. And it said, we went through and we spent the ammunition that we had to spend.
Uh-huh.
Then they took us out on their SEAL boats. And this guy's standing up there with a .222 up in the SEAL boat, shoots a SEAL in the head that's out 50 yards.
Yeah.
One shot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that he said, well, they don't understand using a whole bunch of shots to shoot at paper.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
No, it's just, it's not in their system. You know?
Right.
But when you have to hit something,
yep.
You know, there's a reason for that.
Yep. They know how to do it now.
And they had this one SEAL, was a black guy, and he's about 6'6", weighed about 220 pounds,
uh-huh.
And most of it in his shoulders and chest.
Yeah, right.
Well, if you go to the Board of Trade bar, the Eskimos go, hey, you want to fight? Like going, you know, they're always looking for somebody to fight. And he comes in and says, hey, any guys give you trouble, just tell them I'll fight.
That took care of that.
No, but it's a lot of good times. You know,
yeah.
I miss that. One thing I still miss, I see a fighter going to land in Elmendorf. Oh, I used to do that.
Yeah.
What was your favorite plane to fly?
Oh, in fighters, I'd say the 102.
Yeah.
That was the most comfortable airplane.
Yeah.
The more sporty airplane was the F-86.
Yeah. Yeah. Was the F-86 the first all-weather plane that...
No, that was probably the F-86D was a radar airplane.
Yeah.
I flew the F-86F. Mm-hmm. That's what they flew during the Korean War. It's
right.
A day fighter.
Yeah.
I did get to fly the F-15 out of Elmendorf.
Oh, no kidding.
Anyway,
wow.
Can't think of his name now. But anyway, when to fly, if you go in a turn, do you fly?
No.
You go in a turn, you got to add power. You know, because you're dumping your lift off your wings, so you got to add more power.
Right.
Well, the F-15, I was kept doing that, and I almost go supersonic. You know, I had power because we were running intercepts on our 130s out in the exercise area, doing simulated firing passes, then pull off. And he said, well, he'll show you something. Take the F-15, you can pull it up. We're getting low on, down on fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So now the thrust was greater than the weight of the airplane.
Right.
Put down that power and accelerate going straight up.
Wow.
I've never done that in an airplane before.
Wow.
But that was a thrill.
That
was a big thrill.
I bet. And did they have air shows out here a lot? Were there...
Well, every year, the Elmendorf has an open house.
Okay.
And it's Thunderbirds or the Blue Angels. The past few times they've had it, the last 2 weeks of July.
Okay.
And I don't know, I've been up here 40 years, and I think 36 of them, the last 2 weeks of July, I'm on the river down at the Kenai.
Oh, right.
I got a cabin on the Kenai River. And the red salmon are running.
Yeah, right. And were there ever any touchy times with Russia being so nearby, or the USSR? Were there any intercepts or any funny stuff that happened that anyone had to respond to? I know that they would fly their bombers real close sometimes.
When I fly out to St. Lawrence Island, I can see Russia from my home front window. Well, you can see Russia from St. Lawrence Island, from Gamble and Savunga. No, the F-15s and the F-4s, they get in and all that. I got Meekened once.
What's that?
Meekening is a covert method of distracting an aircraft through radio navigation.
Oh.
I was up by Barrow, and all of a sudden, I had Barrow tuned in the radio, all of a sudden the needle just swung right over towards Russia.
Oh, no kidding.
You know, and that's, I go to another radio station,
right,
and I could home in on it. But
right.
They had somehow or other targeted the Bethel radio for a short period of time.
You know,
it wouldn't lock on.
Yeah.
It's called Meekening. Every once in a while, I think they do that just to show they can.
Yeah, right.
Or some guys, hey, let's do this.
Yeah.
let's get them.
Some joker over there was playing games, huh? Well, thanks for your time. If you have anything else you can think of that you'd like to talk about, we're all ears. Otherwise,
I can't think of that. If you got any questions,
okay.
The only thing is, I think it's a real shame that this outfit has to move over to Elmendorf.
Yeah. It's kind of upsetting to watch all of these real, close-knit groups.
These buildings have been in planning, for years and years.
Yeah.
Right,
just in time to close everything down. Well, if we have any other questions or think anything, I'll let someone here know.
Okay, let Scott know.
Yeah, we'll give you a call and chat, but we sure appreciate your time.
Well, I'm glad to do it.
All your recollections and sort of overall, this is going to be used because the base is closing. We've been tasked with doing a history book, basically. So it's going to be one of the big glossy, sort of coffee table books about the history of Kulis Air Force or Air National Guard Base. So you'll be in there somehow. You'll be a part of that. So and part of that is interviewing people that have been here for a long time or have experience with the base that's more than just sort of recent stuff. So,
well, there's probably a lot of people around that. It's since I retired, the people I know that smoked, there's only one of them left alive.
Are there? If there's other folks that you know of that are in the area that have been here for a while that have maybe retired and aren't out here anymore.
Larry Connolly.
Larry Connolly.
Two O's, two L's, two N's,
okay.
A C and a Y.
Okay.
That's what he says. No, he was here when I got here.
Okay.
And he was one of our flight engineers.
Okay. Is he still in the area?
Yes.
Then?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if he's in the phone book.
Okay.
Larry C. Connolly.
Okay.
I'll write that down.
Shoot, I didn't know you were going to be here, sir. I've been here.
Oh, hey.
How you doing?
Chatting
away. One of our
here.
Former navigators.
Yeah.
Yeah,
what are you doing now?
I still work here.
Oh.
I'm the environmental guy on the base.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I remember when it was at the Sports and Warehouse. That thing.
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to... Don't tell him what I said about him.
Okay. That's confidential.
He came up here recommended by his cousin.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's a bad thing. You're not going to believe this, but my cousin actually got a job.
I believe I feel sorry for who he's working for.
On an oil rig down in the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, okay. That's far enough away.
So the cousin doesn't come highly recommended,
yeah.
Huh?
That was a good trip that I had. It was on, went down, he had a 123, and his cousin was our navigator, and we had a navigator from the Royal Air Force from England, Colin Bell, and Lynn Graham, myself, and I can't remember if Larry Conley was in. Anyway, what we did, we went down and landed at every runway we could land at, from King Salmon on down to Attu.
Wow.
And they built a whole bunch of strips there during World War II.
Okay.
And during the Aleutian campaign. Mm-hmm. And then when the Aleutian campaign was over, they took all their heavy equipment they had and spotted it on the runway, so it couldn't be used.
Right.
But they wanted to find out which, and these were still carried as active runways.
Oh wow!
So we flew over and took pictures of all of them. Every place we go, we get. At Kodiak, they made us up box lunches to get us down to Shemya, to ADAC, and they had box lunches.
Okay.
His cousin would go through them all and get all the desserts out of them.
Oh, no, that wasn't my cousin. No.
He
flew on the 123s. I think you're talking about that other gentleman that I knew that flew in the F-4 Phantoms out of Oklahoma.
That guy.
I thought, boy, you told me directly if that had been the only guy that recommended me, he wouldn't let me in the unit. I remember that.
Well, we were at Shemya, and we are went at Shemya, and there's right next to the runway, there's where their quarters were, we stayed. But we had to go all the way over to the base, which is about a 2.5 mile drive, I think. Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't. No, I'm not going to get up. So we went over, we ate, come back, get in the airplane. Hey, I haven't had breakfast yet. I was hoping he wouldn't get on the airplane, because I'd have left him.
You'd have just left him.
Huh? and he was a navigator, and to finally get, I can't navigate. And Colin Bell said, well, can I try? he's from England. And by the time that 2 weeks is over, all the crew is speaking with English accent.
Yeah.
But he said, let me do it. And he turned on the Loran. And he could position, okay, there's an island 1/4 mile off to our left. But they don't have any runways depicted out. Every once in a while, we flew at about 200 feet because we had steering to the clouds out there.
Right.
There was an island over there. What was his name?
You did better than that guy.
You know, I'm trying to remember what that guy's name was.
Anyway, he wouldn't get back in the navigation. No, he just sat back and back the whole time.
This is the same guy that they just spent $250,000 on one of these F-4 Phantoms to get the radar up and running. He had one working perfect, and he took off. And it didn't work. And there was a switch for an emergency. You could do that would bypass everything and throw current directly to the magnetron. He did it. He completely obliterated. They kicked him out of the unit for that.
Just fried it.
Yeah. Oh, this is on a training mission. Why would you do that?
Wow. Sounds like that guy was.
He wasn't very
much loved. Huh?
You know, he made lieutenant colonel, but.
That's what they do. They just promote him out of their unit because they didn't want him, right?
We landed at Nunavak, and that was a stopover point in case of emergencies, or in case of weather was bad for Reeve Airlines when they were flying.
Oh, okay.
And they had bunks that we could use. Mm-hmm. And we had a Jeep on the 123. So when we get on a Jeep, we could drive around and see what the condition of the runways were. And they had the... there's sheep herders on Umnak Island, and so they said drop in, to let them know you're there, because they sort of keep an eye on the runway, and it's about 5 miles where the runway is.
Wow.
So we drove on there and got there, and here's four people standing up there. They don't get traffic out there. Nobody's on that island. Yeah. Well,
that's exciting business.
And here comes a Jeep. Where'd you come from? They took us in and fed us.
Oh,
can't beat that.
Yeah.
probably happy to have the company, huh? What's the most isolated place that you flew to while you were flying?
I don't know. The last point of land in Alaska is Attu. So we went to Attu, and then in the 130, we flew the Minister of Health of Japan, I think it was. He's sort of the number three man in the Japanese government out to dedicate a titanium monument they have out there to the dead of World War II, the attack on Engineer Hill.
Right.
And a guy had written a speech for me, a guy at state headquarters, on what the information was. And by the time I got out there, there wasn't much left of it. I didn't cross this out. And I'm glad I did, because the wind is blowing, it's cold, and everybody's trying to talk right with their tongues.
Yeah.
that was a good trip. But.
Yeah.
It's a lot of neat places to go flying around Alaska.
Oh, yeah. You can go 10 miles and be in the most isolated place you've ever been.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I used to have a little airplane, and I would fly it right across the way over here. They had X's on those runways, but those old gas line runways, I'd land there anyway. And, you know, Alaskans don't believe in nobody telling them what to do either. And, literally 10 minutes of flying, and you were completely, if I'd have broken an airplane there, I might have been there a long time.
We saw a picture somewhere down there of the Pope visiting. Was that Elmendorf where the Pope came, or was that actually here?
Yeah, that was here.
Wow.
Oh, I didn't know
that. Is it by it says Alaska Air National Guard?
Yeah.
Behind him?
What was he doing here? Just stopping over or coming to visit or?
I don't know, take confession? I don't know. No, that was his first visit to America, I think.
Wow.
Oh, no. And then they had a mass down on the Park Strip downtown, and there was about 62,000 people, I think, down there.
Wow.
And that's the biggest crowd ever in Alaska. Well, the open house in Elmendorf draws 70,000.
Oh, wow. And what year was that the Pope came?
I didn't know he ever came. Probably before me.
It was after 76, I know that.
Yeah, I started flying in 84. Yeah. So, and it was
somewhere
before
in that
me.
Window, yeah. Yeah, it was just funny. We saw.
We're like, it's the Pope. And he's standing there, and it looks like he's about to join the guard, because he says, join the guard and get ahead, and he's heading towards them.
They had the. Our main hangar, our big hangar there, as a backup in case it was inclement weather for his arrival.
Oh, right.
Because there's going to be a big crowd of people.
Yeah.
But the weather's good enough, so that was over across the runway is where that.
Yeah.
But the recruiters got that truck parked.
It was good.
It was by design.
Yeah, it looked funny. It looked like the Pope was going to join up. Were there any other visiting dignitaries that of note that came through here?
Robert Cummings was here, and that day he had people going around. If we're going to take pictures, only take pictures. I forget what side, but he got very irritated. His pictures taken from the wrong side. But we had USO. Randy Travis was here. Have you heard Lee Greenwood's song, "The Northern"? Lights in My Woman's Eyes.
Yep.
Well, the West Virginia Air National Guard was taking Lee Greenwood on a tour around the South Pacific.
Oh.
Well, halfway through, our airplane relieved that airplane and our crew. And it was something, they were in a hotel or something with Lee Greenwood, and he's visiting with the crew, and he said, the song's about Alaska. He says, I'm getting a little tired of Take Me Home Country Roads, he's singing that. And I forget what Alaska songs are, the Alaska theme song. And he said, well, I'll write one. So he wrote that. And okay. He had a recording made while they're still on the trip and gave a CD of that to all the crew.
Wow. Boy, that's pretty cool.
They had a commander's conference down in Jacksonville, Florida. And one of the open entertainers there was Lee Greenwood. You know, and he's wearing the Alaska Air National Guard cap.
Oh, no kidding. So it must have been a memorable trip for him, too, huh? Cool.
I have all politicians around, but darn if I remember which ones. I mean...
Oh, yeah,
George
Miller, governors.
Yeah, governors of all governors.
Commander Alaska Air Command.
Mm-hmm. And when did the Alaska Air Command cease to, when did they get rolled into PACAF or whoever was next?
I don't know. It was in the late 80s, you know that, because I retired in 89. It was right about that time.
Yeah. Well,
you missed most of it.
I'm sorry. I didn't know when it was going to start.
Oh,
I would have loved to have heard your stories.
Oh. Well, we'll send you a copy there.
There used to be an old gentleman who lived across the street from me. He died when he was 94 here in town, and he used to tell me some of the neatest stories about Alaska before it got crowded. It was really cool.
Who else do you think of was here? I gave him Larry Conley. He was here when I got here. Mm-hmm. Most of the other ones smoked and they're dead now.
Yeah. Remember that guy that was in vehicle maintenance that was here from about the time it started? He was a low-ranking guy. I can't remember what his name was. And he only retired here maybe 8 or 10 years ago or 15. I don't know. Wasn't too many.
Well, Steve Phillips was a state employee. Was here. Yeah. He's still around.
I was thinking of that guy that worked at Vehicle Maintenance. I can't think of his name. I'm not good with names anyway. Faces I got.
Lee Strand?
No, he worked for Leaf.
Oh.
Can't think of it. Just one of them things. I'll think of it next week, you know. I don't need it.
In the middle of the night.
Oh, how about Buckaloo?
Buckaloo's out of town this week. We called and tried to talk to him yesterday.
Well, how about his son? He's in the motor pool.
Yeah, his son was
Seaborn here. Buckaloo Jr. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's still in the motor pool or not.
Well, you're talking about the original Buckaloo.
Oh, yeah, him, yeah.
Okay, yeah, we didn't call him. I didn't know exactly how to even get a hold of him, the old guy. But I'm thinking the young guy's once on vacation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Buck here. You know, people, they, around here anyway, it seems like they retire, and about half the time they either leave or you don't ever hear from them again. They just disappear. Sometimes I'll run into somebody at the commissary or something that I wasn't expecting. Smokey, I ran into him the other day. Remember him?
I can't think
what his last name was. I always called
Stover.
Him Smokey. Stover.
Yeah.
He'd been here a long time.
So is it harder to know who was under your command as the years went on? Things probably...
Oh, yeah, and I come out here and I don't know anybody.
Yeah.
Ken Soik is here. I know he's in town. S-O-I-K.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true. He's been here a long time, or was here a long time.
Yeah.
That other guy that was there, what's his name? I don't know how long he was
Twinstrip?
Here. Who?
Twinstrip? Don't remember him. But.
No, I was thinking of a guy that was the chief. Andy, God, I just called him Andy. I can't think of what his last name was.
Harold Wolverton was the commander out here when I got here.
Is he still around?
I saw him at the hardware store yesterday.
Oh,
I see him about once a year.
Wow. Okay. Well,
he'd be a good one because he was here for a long time before I got here.
Okay. Well, that might be another one.
I don't know if Whitey Moore's around anymore or not.
Some of these names I don't even know.
He's the one I replaced as commander.
Yes, you were commander before I ever got here.
When you said that when you started there were 17 pilots and 2 navigators. How many when you left?
Oh, hell, I
don't know. About 18 nafs or something, roughly.
That's...
We had a picture at one time of all the navigators in the unit at one time. We got everybody here on the trail.
I think that's a photo where we saw you.
You probably...
Yeah, I think that's about...
On the DC-3?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was every navigator in the unit at that particular moment.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was somebody realized that everybody's here. They grabbed the photographer.
Yeah.
Wow. Ed Granger.
He's,
I believe he's still in Anchorage. He was the one, I was just fresh up here, so I was a co-pilot. When I flew those 19 flights mm-hmm. into Fairbanks in 9 days, he was the pilot.
Oh, okay.
And he used to be the director of aviation in Alaska.
Okay.
Yeah, the two navigators also, at the time you were talking about was John Stafford and George Ellich, I believe. Those.
Oh, no, Ganapol.
Oh my, before them.
Ganapol, the two navigators assigned to the unit when I got here was Ganapol and Malmstrom, Swede Malmstrom.
I'll be darned. Never heard those names even. Oh my goodness.
Then I never did meet Swede. He was still in the unit, but he'd moved and he just hadn't got transferred out yet.
Right.
Then our next navigator was George Ellich.
Okay. You know, I saw him just the other day at Paul Smith's thing over here. I don't know, have you heard about Paul Smith?
No.
Oh, he's got a metastasized brain cancer. He's not doing that well. He's got his spirits up, but he's looking frail. And they had a little get-together for him at the club the other day, and a lot of people showed up.
Remember one time, two navigators, they were both instructor navigators and flight examiner navigators, so they took off on the flight and they came back. On the form, you put on there what particular thing was done on that flight, and said, George Ellich successfully completed annual navigator flight proficiency.
Right.
Underneath was...
Stafford.
Jerry Ganapol failed his annual flight exam.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, that sucks.
They'd take it again, huh? That's pretty funny. Was there a lot of competition for, I don't know what the staffing was like for... at the base or for the aircraft, was there a lot of competition to get up and get as many hours as you could in the aircraft?
No,
or did,
not,
or
not
did
really.
You pretty it's much a, fly as much as you wanted to?
Yeah, we got a it was 3 people specifically that were coming over from Elmendorf that I was their commanders at Elmendorf strongly recommended I not take them. 2 of them were pilots,
mm-hmm.
and I can't remember who the second pilot was, but another one was Scott something or other. But anyway, he said all he wants to do is fly. Well, that's what we want in the Guard.
Yeah.
We want people to fly. We don't want everybody to be chief of staff.
Yeah, right.
And the other one was flight surgeon, Jerry Richter.
Oh, I remember him.
Remember him? And the hospital commander called. They sent a letter over. Don't accept them because all he's interested in is taking care of people.
What is wrong with
him? See, over there, he's got to move up. He's got to get into leadership, into management. Well, Jerry didn't want to do that. If you threw him into a Aboriginal community, he'd be in hog heaven.
Yeah.
Because he'd love...
Yeah.
Well, that's what we want.
Yeah. He
retired here as a full colonel.
Scott Allen was it.
Oh, Scotty Allen?
Yeah,
he was a good pilot, but a little bit odd.
Oh, yeah.
I love flying with him. If he just quit smoking. Oh, my God, he was a chain smoker. I think he would light one from the other. Then they made no smoking in the cockpits of the airplane.
Oh.
He was very upset. I don't know if you knew that or not. He was really upset.
I remember was taking a flight, was flying in one of our tanker aircraft, and John Schaefer was the adjutant general, and if he wasn't smoking, he was sleeping. You know, he didn't sleep much. Well, he's drinking too, but he's always had a cigarette going. Well, yeah. He was going. We're taking him down to McGee Tyson, and that's when they no smoking in the cockpit.
Yeah.
And so, who's the? He was commander here for a while.
Oh, the blonde haired, the white haired guy from Fairbanks.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm trying to think of his name.
Anyway, he.
I know who you're talking about. He owned the car dealer up there.
Yeah, he's. The smoker like John Schaefer. Oh, so he motivated permission to smoke in the cockpit. And he sent it back for him for John Schaefer to sign. And John Schaefer says, I quit, you quit. Tom.
Oh, I'm trying to think what that guy's name was. He had a car dealership in Fairbanks, the one I'm thinking of. Mm-hmm. And that was he was a commander for a Phil something or other. I'm thinking of. Gosh, you forget too much.
Yeah, that's right.
You got a better memory than me. Christ, you're pulling out names. Goodness, sir.
Yeah. See, who's Ken Taylor's not around anymore. He lives down in Arizona. Yeah. He's. Newcomer. Larry Connolly is the one that I remember, know that was here longer than I was, or before I was.
Yeah. Well, we'll try to get a hold of him while we're up here. If not, we'll talk to him on the phone, maybe.
I wish I had George's cell phone number, George Ellich. I cannot, I never had it, and he's in town.
Let's see, Wolverton. I know he's in town because I saw him at the hardware store.
Yeah.
And I'm sure his name's in the phone book and he lives in this area someplace.
Okay.
Around here.
Great.
It's been a wonderful place to work, I tell you that. I hate the
Gresh, Tom Gresh.
Oh, Tom Gresh. Gresh.
Yeah.
Is he around here?
No, he retired.
Yeah, I wonder, like Wyoming or
someplace.
Well,
he went from here to be the guard liaison for PACAF.
Yeah, in PACAF, but after he retired, I thought he went back to ranching or something. I don't know. I don't know for sure. Tom Gresh was the one that hired me into my full-time job. Yeah.
Now, he's a good troop.
He was. Nice guy. I don't think he got along very well with Ken Taylor.
Nobody really did.
That's what I heard.
No, he tolerated major. We used to call them major gadgets, because he'd get every new gadget come out. He'd get it.
Yeah.
I wonder. Well, I don't know if it'd be the best reference. I'm not even sure where he lives. Dan Nice is still alive. I know. I don't know.
I would be cautious. I don't know why he was fired. I have a suspicion, but it.
Well, the word around the base was he didn't have good morals.
Yeah, that's it.
Overnight, summarily executed as commander, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, that's part of our history. You don't need to write it down, but.
Well, thank you guys.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming out, sir.
Thanks for putting time in on this.
Yeah, well, we're glad to be out here. So,
where do you live now?
We're both from Denver, Colorado. So, we're just up for the week, and I guess one of our other co-workers, a couple of co-workers were here, about 2 years ago, I think.
Yeah, Margie and some other folks were here earlier.
Working on some of the well, on sort of a separate project that sort of led to this. So we managed to get up here every couple of years, it seems like. So, but we're sad it's because you are closing down here instead of just for history's sake, you know.
I love this little base. I just hate to see it go. I'm not going to go in Elmendorf. As soon as this base closes, I'm done.
Yeah.
Is that still 2011?
Sometime in there. They're talking late 10 or middle of 11. They got to be done by the end of 11. You know, in the fiscal year 11, they've got to be
done. How are they doing for facilities over there?
I guess they're getting them coming right along. They got some they're getting ready to construct, some they're renovating. You know, we're going to be like everywhere all over the base.
Oh, that's a shame. You're all going to be in one spot.
Right. You're going to...
What a pain.
Coolis won't really exist over there.
No.
Well, I don't think they can call another base. I mean,
I don't know.
No, I mean, when they commission these places, they're commissioned as such, and I don't think they can... can't take the Coolis name.
You and I both are probably one of very few people that ever saw the people the base was named after come here and visit, if you remember. The widow of the person our base was named after was here. And they dedicated the kind of airplane out here that he was flying when he was killed.
From some photos, it looked like she went up and flew around a bit.
Did she? I didn't know that for sure. Yeah. She may have. Yeah. But she was here. I remember that.
Yeah. Ruth Coolis.
Yep.
Yeah.
Seemed like a nice lady.
She used to be a stewardess in Wien Airlines.
No kidding.
On DC-3s.
No kidding.
And they go up their own when they overnighted in Nome. Her and the other stewardess, their job was to go de-ice the air, to scrape the ice off the wings of the airplane.
No.
Stewardesses were different then.
Yeah.
You had to be a hardy type.
Yeah, a little tougher.
They were working girls in the literal sense of the word.
Figurative sense. Well, maybe they were too. I don't know.
No, they weren't. Not this lady. Yeah, I'll tell you that.
Wow.
I don't know. That almost brought tears to my eyes when they played that song and had her there accepting that.
Yeah.
I remember that still.
Yeah. Well, I don't. What are they going to do when they? I mean. What happens to all these facilities?
FAA gets part of it, don't they?
They're being divvied up. The airport actually is going to own all this, but some of it the FAA, I think, is going to lease or something like
occupy.
That. They may be able to take our lease over, I don't know, on some of it, and then I don't really know. I don't think anybody really does at this point.
Yeah. What was the relationship like with the airport back and forth through the years? Has it always
good.
Been
it was good. Good?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
The airport director of security was Johnny Hines when I was commander. And we had three of his people, the airport security people, were in the guard.
Oh.
And he got highly upset because... You know, they have a guard mission. They go, you know, got to go to the guard, you know, and go over it, and it screws up a schedule.
Right.
And so he said he'd like to talk to me about it. So I went over to his office, and he said, yes, Tim Foster was one of them. He was one of our security people here, you know, and he said, well, I got to go with the guard. I got guard duty. And he said, you know, I have to make up my schedule 2 weeks ahead of time. And these guys, you know, when they come in, it really messes me up.
Right.
And I said, I can give you their schedule a year ahead of time if you want it. You know? How can you do that? He says, they don't know when they're going to have to be. No, if they're coming over here on guard duty, it's because they have requested it. They're yanking your chain.
Yeah.
And I had the same conversation with the police chief, you know, because he was going, hey, I can give you a schedule. Well, what about these flights they have to take that they're gone for 3 or 4 days? I said, they don't have to take them. We got you know, other people to take them. They're volunteering for those flights.
Yeah.
But,
Well, that's
so from then on, we got along good.
Yeah, right.
Tim Foster wasn't too pleased.
That's good. I mean, at least they like their job enough to want to come back and do it more on a volunteer basis.
Oh, yeah. It's because a good flight would come up. You know, something.
Right.
Oh, hey, we got the... Well, I don't know if people really want to go on it, but we usually send an airplane down to the Reno Air Show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I never could get on that one. Huh? I never could get on that flight.
Well, I went to grad school in Reno, and every year at the air show, when Stead Air Force Base closed down, that turned into university housing, and I was in... They had graduate and married student housing in the old officers' quarters right across the road from the tarmac there. And every year they'd have, you know, dozens of those really souped up P-51s.
Yeah.
And I had windows crack. They would rattle so bad from all of those guys across the thing. And I had to...
Sending them down to you.
Yeah, I had to vacate during that week because I couldn't... I was trying to study and I had exams and stuff. And man, it was loud.
I went to Reno, went to Squaw Valley.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Go skiing?
No.
Just look at it?
No.
Fly over it?
No.
Fishing?
Huh?
Fishing?
No.
Oh. What was it?
It's spent 2 weeks in a parachute teepee.
Oh.
Oh,
that's when it was a survival school.
Oh.
Squaw Valley was a wilderness.
Yeah.
All
right. And that's where Air Force Survival School was for a long time. Right?
Interesting. I know that Stead Air Force Base was the survival school, of the survival schools for the Air Force.
No, the main one now is Fairchild.
Right.
Before, that was the main survival school.
Well, they had, it sounded like they had three or four different ones, and then those all finally consolidated to Fairchild after a while.
That seems strange, you guys living up here in Alaska, and then them sending you down there for...
Well, I was in the Air Force then. I was stationed in Montana.
Yeah. That's good.
I was flying F-84s.
Yeah.
Got home Christmas Eve.
Oh.
No kidding.
It's more than just how to survive out in the boom toolies, too. They teach you a little bit about in case you get captured and stuff.
Right, yeah.
Which you probably would hope you never, ever need.
Yeah.
Yeah, Fairchild, now they have the POW camp. That was one of the projects we worked on was...
Well, a replication of it?
No, surveying that base and some of the things that we had to...
Oh.
The buildings we had to look at were some of the POW, the survival and POW... camp, the mock POW camp, so they put you through.
I was probably in that camp at one time.
Can the people here get a hold of you? If I run across somebody else that I happen to think of, and I'll pass it on.
You know what? In fact, I'll just let me give you a card, and then you'll have it. And you can get a hold of.
We'll give you two
directly.
Thank you. That's us.
And I think you gave one to Scott, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So we're around and available, at least for this week, and then after that, we're available to talk on the phone anytime. So.